Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 270, Creer versus Black Michael and the Courageous Battle of Bronkhorstspruit Women. The approach by the English political parties of the time to the young Boer republics was confused and even contradictory. William Gladstone, a liberal, had succeeded in ousting the Tories under Benjamin Disraeli in his famous Midlothian campaign of 1879 and 1880. In 1880, Gladstone formed his second ministry, and almost immediately, the promises he'd made about forswearing foreign wars were broken. There's a direct link between what was going on in South Africa and in Ireland. These two territories, so far apart geographically, featured as joint threats in the English mind of the time. The most direct link is Gladstone himself. He had criticized the annexation of the Transvaal during his Midlothian campaign, but once in power, he hesitated to reverse British policy, fearing a domino effect where weakness in Pretoria would lead to revolution in Dublin. By 1880, the Irish nationalists began to see the Boers not just as fellow farmers, but as fellow victims of British coercion. This Irish link flourished throughout the 19th and part of the 20th century, with Irish nationalists fighting for the Boers during the Second Anglo-Boer War. The shift in Irish nationalist alignment was driven by a move from anti-imperial solidarity to human rights internationalism. Initially, the Irish supported the Boers as fellow peasant republicans fighting the British Empire. But as the 20th century progressed, the Irish Republican movement increasingly identified with the ANC, viewing the struggle against apartheid as a mirror to their own fight against institutionalized discrimination in Northern Ireland. By the height of the Cold War, the Irish Republican Army's Marxist-leaning leadership saw the Afrikaner government as a pro-Western colonialist proxy, leading them to provide tactical advice and training to Mkhonto weSizwe, the ANC's armed wing, to help dismantle the very state they had once ideologically championed. So at first, they were close allies in both spirit and in their political expression. The South African crisis, which led to the First Boer War of 1880 and 1881, occurred because the British government claimed to be the paramount authority and trustee of South Africa, and the Boers rejected this claim. As you've heard in the series, the British aim from the 1860s onwards was to try and cajole the Orange Free State and Transvaal into a federation with the Cape and Natal colonies. The Cape was dead set against the idea of federating with the Boer republics because it would be a drain on their fiscus. The republics in turn were embittered by the loss of Basutoland and Griqualand West with its diamonds and were in no mood to give up independence for the flag of their oppressors. Then, of course, all the conditions of South African politics were altered by the discovery of diamonds. By the end of 1880, more than £8 million had been sunk into developing Kimberley, and largely because of the value of mining, the Cape government had been able to borrow £10 million to build railway lines. Diamonds almost tripled the value of South African foreign trade within a decade. The flow of immigrants and speculation on rising land values gave fresh impetus to the colonists' expropriation of black land. Strategically, the Cape route eastward had not been as negatively affected as presumed by the opening of the Suez Canal. The Colonial Office in the 1870s was writing about how Cape Town was the true center of the empire, and this only intensified during the century. Cape Town did not have the complications of the Suez Canal and was almost equally distant from Australia, China, India, Gibraltar, the West Indies, and the Falklands. In 1875, when Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli's government bought a 44% stake in the Suez Canal Company, Britain became physically and financially tethered to Egypt. This locked in Suez as supposedly the primary imperial artery, but the canal was fragile. A single sunken ship or a local nationalist uprising would block the empire's main artery, which was precisely what happened in 1882. £91 million of British trade passed through Cape Town in 1878, compared to just £65 million through the Suez. By the way, the source of these stats comes from the report of the Royal Commission on Colonial Defence, CO 812/38, if you're interested. In their minds, the safety of the whole empire might hang one day on the control of the naval base at Simonstown and South Africa's shores. So the strategy was to exclude other European powers from this vital corner of the maritime world. Between 1877 and 1880, the Taika, the Maxhosa, the Bapedi, the Griqua, the Batlapping, the Baralong, the Zulu, and the Basutu had all risen up in various ways to defend what was left of their patrimony. Local officials like Sir Bartle Frere and Theophilus Shepston believed these were portents of some great connected black uprising led by the Zulu against the settlers. The Anglo-Zulu War had been condemned by the Aborigines Protection Society, branding it as morally indefensible, and it was Gladstone who had demanded that Frere be fired and that the annexation of the Transvaal had always been a mistake. The Transvaal Boers threw over Thomas Francois Burgers themselves, who had consented to that annexation. At the extreme, the conflict between the descendants of the Voortrekkers and the British was one of 17th century Calvinist frontiersmen against the official representatives of the 19th century imperialism, which paraded itself as the guiding light of liberal and humanistic metropolis. In Cape politics, the rise of Jan Hofmeyr's Farmers Protection Association marked the growth of Afrikaner group consciousness in reaction to Anglicization. The Afrikaner Bond began mobilizing in the Cape, the Transvaal, and the Orange Free State. Initially, both Hofmeyr and the Free State President Brandt had acquiesced to the annexation of the Transvaal, but by 1880, both had switched to supporting the Transvaal claim of independence. Hofmeyr wrote in the said Afrikaner that die annexatie van die Transvaal heeft het volk van Suid-Afrika geleer dat bloed dikker is dan water. The annexation of the Transvaal has taught the people of South Africa that blood is thicker than water. Blood, yes, is thicker than water, but medically only if it's been pumped slowly. Compared to the slow-motion car crashes of 21st century warfare, the First Anglo-Boer War was a model of punctuality. The Boers managed to bankrupt British prestige in 3 months, a feat of timing that today's autocrats can only dream of. Majuba was going to be both a viscous and vicious shock for the Redcoats. In the minds of the Liberals and Radicals, yes, they called themselves the Radicals, back in England, both the Transvaalers and the Zulu had been done an injustice. Before coming to power, William Gladstone had spoken of the Transvaal, a country where we have chosen most unwisely, I am tempted to say insanely, to place ourselves in the strange predicament of the free subjects of a monarchy going to coerce the free subjects of the Republic to compel them to accept a citizenship which they decline and refuse. But the Liberals, Gladstone's party, turned from principle to pragmatism as soon as they came to power, which is what happens a lot in politics, where promises made to a seemingly gullible electorate are seldom kept. Earlier in 1878, Paul Creer and Piet Joubert had sailed to London with a petition signed by over 6,500 Boers demanding the reversal of the Transvaal annexation. Sir Michael Hicks Beach had just taken over as colonial secretary from the more diplomatic and polite Lord Carnarvon. Hicks Beach was nicknamed Black Michael, referring to his famously long dark beard, his tall, thin, imposing frame, and his legendary dark temper. He was known for being abrasive, combative, and having very little patience for those who didn't respect British authority. In the House of Commons, even his allies found him intimidating, and his attitude towards the Boer leaders was curt. Hicks Beach was far less interested in Confederation talk than his predecessor. He simply wanted the Transvaal to submit. He refused to even discuss the legality of the annexation. Most insultingly to the Boers, Hicks Beach declared at their first interview that he would only communicate via written correspondence. For Creer, a man of the oral tradition, who believed in looking a man in the eye to settle a deal, this was seen as cowardly and deeply crude evasion of duty. In the few moments they did speak, Hicks Beach was famously brusque. He essentially told Creer that self-government would only be considered if the Boers behaved themselves and stopped protesting, and allowed neither Creer nor Joubert to respond to his outbursts. Hicks Beach's rudeness helped Creer. When the Transvaal Deputy President returned to South Africa empty-handed, he used the story of Hicks Beach's arrogance to prove that passive resistance was dead. He could tell the burghers, ik ben gegaan om tot hen te spreken als een man, doch Zwarte Michael wilde mij zelfs niet in die ogen zien. Sorry about the bad Dutch accent. I meant to speak to them as a man, and Black Michael wouldn't even look me in the eye. This personal snub fueled the fire that led directly to the gathering at Paardekraal and the outbreak of war in 1880. More about that in a minute. By June 1880, the sympathy of the Cape Dutch with their annexed kinsfolk across the Vaal had grown significantly and destroyed all chance of early unification. The Cape Parliament voted down all federation proposals, largely at the insistence of Clear and Joubert, as well as the Cape Farmers' Party. The Transvaalers and the Cape Dutch had turned the tables on the British. When we look at this period as an inevitable first major Anglo-Boer war coming up, it was not inevitable at the time. British politics was in even more turmoil than it is now, strange but true. To the English, it seemed that South Africa was on the verge of becoming another island, the inveterate hostility of whose people might only be held down at tremendous cost by main force. Gladstone and his cabinet grappled with one main question. In both territories, Transvaal and Ireland, should a nationalist reaction be met with coercion or concession? English humanitarians wanted government to reimpose its authority on the Transvaal in order to carry out the duty of social justice, or what was called native trusteeship. The Whig, the Conservative peers in cabinet, preferred to suppress a Boer rebellion out of prestige and supremacy. The Liberals were stuck in the middle. Gladstone prevaricated, as he clearly was sympathetic to the Boer position. But Ireland loomed large over these debates. Should the British go easy on the Boers, the Irish could perceive that as a weakness and rebel. At first, Gladstone brushed aside humanitarian demands for Britain to annex Zululand and undertake their native trusteeship policy there. He'd also overridden humanitarian objection to placing the Griqua and black groups in Griqualand West under direct colonial administration. Both Liberals and Conservatives were anxious to get rid of the burden of the Transvaal and grant them responsible government status like the Cape. Unlike many previous conflicts, the Boers had rejected a British request to send the commander into Zululand during the Anglo-Zulu War, further exacerbating their crumbling relationship. By late 1880, the Transvaal Boers had spent 3 years under British annexation, watching the promises of local autonomy evaporate under the increasingly autocratic rule of the British administrator, Sir Owen Lanyon. The physical revolt began over a wagon. In November 1880, a Boer named Piet Besaidenhout refused to pay an extra tax to the British, claiming he had already paid his dues to the previous Boer government. The British seized his wagon and attempted to sell it at an auction in Potchefstroom on November 11th. Under the leadership of Piet Cronier, a group of armed Boers rode into town, reclaimed the wagon from the sheriff, and returned it to Besaidenhout's farm. This act was the point of no return. It was an open challenge to British legal authority. From December 8th to the 13th in 1880, between 8,000 and 10,000 Boers gathered at Paardekraal near modern-day Krugersdorp. This was an extraordinary assembly of the folk. On December 13th, they passed a resolution formally restoring the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek. They drafted a proclamation of independence, declaring they were willing to die for their freedom. A leadership group called the Triumvirate, or Driemanskap, was created where Paul Kruger was elected vice president, Piet Joubert commandant general, and Martinus Wessel Pretorius, a kind of symbolic seal of legitimacy. W.M. Pretorius was the son of Andries Pretorius, the victor of Blood River, and the primary negotiator of the Sunt River Convention that originally secured Transvaal independence in 1852. Pretorius had served as the president of both the South African Republic and the Orange Free State multiple times, so his presence in the leadership was a legal maneuver. It allowed the Boers to argue that the transition back to independence wasn't a new government, but a restoration of the old one. He provided the constitutional face to the revolt. More importantly, Pretorius was often the moderating influence between the two younger, more ambitious lions of the movement, the deeply conservative religious Kruger and the more modern liberal Joubert. He was the grand old man of the Boer cause. While he lacked Kruger's sharp political instinct and Joubert's tactical brilliance on the battlefield, he was the glue that kept the two rivals from turning on each other during the high-stress coming months. In a moment of intense cultural significance, each burgher placed a stone on a pile at Paardekraal, swearing a solemn oath to stand together until independence was won. The act of placing a stone on a pile, the creation of a cairn or klipstapel, is one of the most ancient and universal human gestures of memory and covenant. At Paardekraal, in December 1880, it transformed a political meeting into a sacred, irreversible blood oath. South Africans of many denominations have an affiliation with stone cairns. It is deeply felt in Xhosa and wider Nguni traditions, and known as Isivavani. Travellers or warriors would add a stone to a heap at a significant place such as a mountain pass or a boundary to ask for protection or to pay respect to the ancestral spirits of the land. Hikers still do this today. It is a collective contribution to a common purpose. One stone is insignificant, but the pile represents an undeniable weight of a community. For the burghers of Pas de Kraal, many of whom had grown up on the frontiers in close and often violent proximity to the Xhosa and Zulu cultures, the power of a stone testimony was a language they understood, even though they framed it through a biblical lens. For the deeply religious Boers, the act was specifically modeled after the Old Testament. They viewed themselves as the Israelites, and the stones were their mizpah, Hebrew for watchtower. Genesis 31. Jacob and Laban gathered stones into a heap to serve as a witness to their covenant. Just a quick aside, this act was so powerful that after the war, the Pas de Kraal monument was built over that very site. During the Second Anglo-Boer War, between 1899 and 1902, the British recognized the psychological power of those stones and dismantled part of the cairn, throwing the stones into the Vaal River to try and break the spell of Boer unity. After this oath, the Boers chose Dingaan's Day, December 16th, the anniversary of the Battle of Blood River, to raise the Vier Kleur, the four-colour flag at Heidelberg, which they declared their provisional capital. But the first shots were going to be fired in Potchefstroom. Commandos entered the West Transvaal town on the 15th of December, much to the surprise of the British garrison there, who had been rushed into town a few days before. Colonel Winslow led a field force of 2 guns, 25 mounted infantry of the Royal Scots Fusiliers, along with 2 companies from the same regiment, to bolster the handful of British troops in Potch. All told, they numbered 213. They retreated into their tiny fort, which was about the size of a tennis court, and the jail, as well as the Landdrost's office, while the Boers took possession of the town. The commander was led by Piet Cronier, and he handed out copies of their Proclamation of Independence. A British patrol from the fort fired on them, killing a Boer, and Cronier's men returned fire. The siege of the British garrison at Potchefstroom had begun. Over the next few days and weeks, the Boers mounted a number of attacks on the fort. In one assault, Piet Cronier had his horse shot out from under him. In a few days, 800 Boers surrounded the fort, that number growing to 1,400. The siege was going to last the entire length of the war, 3 months, with the garrison eventually surrendering due to starvation, which was a shame, because both besiegers and besieged had no idea that an armistice had already been signed. However, the Battle of Bronkhorstspruit, fought on December 20th, 1880, serves as the most explosive opening act of the First Anglo-Boer War, and that had a very different result. The conflict began when a British column from the 94th Regiment, led by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Ainstruther, was marching from Leidenburg to reinforce Pretoria. Carrying heavy supplies and accompanied by some wives and children, the 260-strong column was intercepted by a Boer commander of 300 men under Frans Joubert. The engagement started with a tense cinematic parley. A Boer messenger approached under a flag of truce, delivered an ultimatum, stop the march or face immediate hostilities. When Ainstruther flatly refused, stating his orders were to proceed, the Boer marksmen, who had already taken up concealed positions, opened fire. The British were completely caught off guard in a vulnerable marching formation. Their band was still playing Kiss Me Mother as the first shots rang out. The battle was a short clinical disaster for the British. In just 15 minutes, Boer marksmanship decimated the column, specifically targeting officers and NCOs. Watching this shocking incident were the families of the 94th Regiment. 3 women in particular played a remarkably courageous and often overlooked role during and after this massacre. While the soldiers fought and fell, the women were thrust into the middle of a literal kill zone, eventually becoming the column's primary caregivers. 3 specific women, Anne Fox, Margaret Maestri, and Marion Smith, became legendary for their bravery. Despite having no formal training, they tended to the wounded while bullets were still flying. Marion Smith even tore up her own clothing to create bandages for the dying. In a desperate move to prevent the regimental colours from being captured as trophies, the soldiers hid them under Anne Fox's bed. She had been shot and lay wounded in a hospital wagon. The colours were later smuggled out of the camp by men who wrapped them around their waists under their coats. With over 150 men killed or wounded, and mortally wounded himself, Ainstruther surrendered. The Boers allowed the families and soldiers to stay and establish a camp and care for the wounded and send for food and water from nearby farms. They then allowed 2 men to walk to Pretoria to bring back a British doctor. Ainstruther died 6 days later. In stark contrast to the British 70 dead and 80 wounded, The Boers suffered only two deaths. This lopsided victory shattered British overconfidence and set the stage for a series of Boer triumphs that would eventually lead to the restoration of the Transvaal's independence. All three women were later awarded the Royal Red Cross by Queen Victoria. Anne Fox died in 1888, her death hastened by the serious wounds she'd sustained. Upon her death, Queen Victoria ordered that she be buried with full military honours. This was a unique tribute for civilian women of the time, attended by the general officer commanding and all corps at Aldershot. By the end of December 1880, the revolt had successfully transformed into a full-scale siege of British authority. Pretoria was completely cut off and under siege, while British garrisons at Potchefstroom, Lydenburg, Rustenburg, Marabastad and Standerton had all been surrounded and isolated. General Sir George Pomeroy Colley, the British governor of Natal, began desperately mobilizing the Natal field force to march north and suppress the rebels, a march that would lead him directly to his doom at Lang's Neck and Majuba Hill. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Till next, goodbye.